This is called The Pod Remains the Same.
Welcome to The Pod Remains the Same, a Led Zeppelin podcast. Join us for a journey through the recording history of one of the greatest bands of all time as we revisit the Led Zeppelin catalog, album by album. This is The Pod Remains the Same with Chris Karam and Brad Page. Episode 5, the live album, How the West Was Won.
Welcome to The Pod Remains the Same, a Led Zeppelin podcast. I'm Chris Karam.
And I'm Brad Page.
And we're here to talk about an album that was recorded 50 years ago this year. And of course, we're talking about How the West Was Won, which was recorded during a series of shows in Los Angeles back in 1972. 50 years, Brad. It's amazing how time passes, huh?
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting that this sat in the vault or whatever till what, 2003, I think, when it was originally released.
It wasn't released till 2003, but I figured because it kind of fits in chronologically, I figured it'd just be a better fit. And I mean, it's obviously, I think it's generally considered among fans or a certain segment of fans that Led Zeppelin was in their live prime around 1971, 72. Would you agree with that, Brad?
I think so. Well, certainly Jimmy Page would agree with you. He's said that this, one of his reasons for releasing this album was that he felt it represented them at their peak. And I think you could make an argument that it's a better live album than the one that was officially released during their period, which we'll talk about eventually. But it is a great performance. And I think that's what I was getting at, that just the idea that they had this, and I mean, it was out floating around on bootlegs. It wasn't an unknown thing, but they had this pretty amazing performance, and it just sort of, sat there for what, 30 years or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you consider that Song Remains the Same wasn't released until 1976, and that was the only live release till, 2000. So yeah, 27 years, pretty much close to 30 years. And of course, Led Zeppelin is probably one of the most heavily bootleg groups in existence, probably second only to the Beatles and maybe even surpassing the Beatles. But, finally this came out. It was released in conjunction with the release of the Led Zeppelin DVD, which we'll talk about in a future episode. One of the funny things about this release, it has nothing to do with the band itself, is that one of the things I read early on was a review where a fan, doing an internet rant, how this was put together from different shows rather than being one, exclusive live performance. And I mean, I don't get that, because most live albums, are put together from multiple shows. You take the best takes and maybe you take them in the studio and polish them up a bit, but you generally want to have the best performances. I mean, I would rather have a good representative, live album rather than maybe, every night if there's some duff performances.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite live albums of all time is Wings Over America, the Paul McCartney and Wings live record, and that was sourced from that entire tour, and they just picked the best version. They recorded every night on that tour and picked the best version and stitched that together in the same sequence that the songs went for the live performance. So essentially, you were just getting the best version of every song from that tour, and I don't see a problem with that. It still represents what it was like to see that tour, which is ultimately one of the goals of a live record, right? Is to capture that particular tour. This was just sourced from two different nights, so I don't find that egregious at all. It's not like they were, and I don't have a problem with choosing songs over the course of an entire tour, let alone between two gigs. Well, we played this one better the first night and this one better the second night. Another one of the greatest live albums of all time, Deep Purple, Made in Japan, was sourced from three gigs in Japan. And they just picked the best one from each night. There's nothing unusual about that, and I don't see any issue with that. If you're looking at it purely from a documentarian state I suppose you could make that argument. And that's one of the appeal of bootlegs for people who just really want to capture a specific night from first note to last. But I think just as for the general listener, as just as a good listening experience, why would you not want to have the best performances that represent that particular tour or just, you know, those two gigs? Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like needless, you know, niggling over, you know, over something that's, you know, like you said, we want the best representations. I don't need to have every, I mean, you know, it might be cool to hear both nights, but I'm fine with a really good representative, you know, three discs. I think this was three discs. You know, I'm curious as to, I wonder if Jimmy, all those years later, touched up anything, you know, maybe did some overdubs. It's certainly possible. Do you think that after all this time, he still would have, you know, overdubbed some parts?
It's tough to say. I have read that there was some extensive editing and tweaking, but that doesn't necessarily mean re-recording, you know what I mean? Or punch-ins or things like that, which that's a whole nother thing. And that happens on a lot of live records too, where you go in and you fix the sloppy moments. And, you know, clearly there's some classic Jimmy sort of little fumbles and the solos and whatnot on here, which to me just adds to the live ambiance of the record. So clearly they didn't fix everything. You never know, right? It's those, that's always part of the mystery. And most artists, particularly a band that, that loves the mystery that surrounds them, they like to keep that going. And so they're not going to tell you. Jimmy Page is not going to tell you what he really did to each one of these tracks. But bottom line is, it just feels like a great Led Zeppelin performance. Whatever they had to do, I think it captures them. Like I said, I think it captures them overall. I think in many places, significantly better performance than Song Remains the Same.
Yeah, this is certainly a group who's just released their, you know, we talked about this in the last episode, their pinnacle album, mm-hmm. and they're clearly riding a wave of creativity and momentum. I mean, by this point, they're no longer an up and coming band. They're a superstar band, and they are, you know, they can command, you know, two nights at the LA Forum or the sports arena, wherever they recorded this. And, you know, all of Led Zeppelin, all their glorious excesses here, you know, you know, Dazed and Confused being like a half hour long, Moby Dick being an extended drum solo, and of course all the little, you know, things that they throw in, but it wouldn't be Led Zeppelin without that stuff. You had the CD format where you could put out a three disc set and not have to, you know, put this on like, you know, I don't know, six or seven vinyl albums. I don't know if it's been released on vinyl since then. It probably has been.
I think it might have been a four. I don't know. I don't have it, but I believe it did at some point come out on vinyl. But yeah, it fits perfectly on three CDs. Pretty extensive show. You know, this is a band that was, that could go on stage and literally play for hours. You know, you can argue whether or not the world needs a almost half hour version of Dazed or Confused or a almost 20 minute drum solo. If you're a huge fan, you love those things. If you're not, maybe it's a little tedious, but there's plenty of great moments on this album to recommend.
Oh yeah. And one thing that should be noted, this album was remastered in 2018. And if you're looking to buy this, if you decide as a result of listening to this, you want to get it, I would advise getting the original 2003 CD release, because there's a whole lot of love, an extended whole lot of love, that's 23 minutes, but it also encases a medley of some classic rock and roll, you know, 50s rock and roll songs. And one of the songs was Hello Mary Lou by Rick Nelson. And that has been taken out of the 2018 reissue. They've just kind of cleverly edited it out because I guess they lost the rights to it, or there was some kind of dispute. Maybe they didn't have the rights to use it in the first place. I don't know. So if you're a purist, you definitely want to get the original 2003 release. And I can't really imagine that the 2018 release sounds that much different. I mean, you know, by that 2003, you know, the CD format was pretty standard, and, you know, most of the CDs coming out at that point sounded pretty good and up to standard. So I would definitely advise getting that, you know.
Yeah, that's the version I have, is the 2003 CD issue. But I bought it fairly recently. Like, I didn't buy it in 2003 when it originally came out. So it's not difficult to find, and it won't cost you a ton of money. But yeah, why not get that version so that you have the original intent, the complete version of it. I believe the vinyl, just doing some lookup while you were talking there, Chris, I believe the vinyl version was four LPs, and that was reissued in 2018. So that the vinyl probably doesn't include Hello Mary Lou, that snippet as well. So yeah, just go back and get the 2003 CD. You can find it for average CD, used CD price, and I think it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they put plenty of them out there. I mean, this was not exactly small release. This was this was the first time, you know, in 27 years that we were getting an official live Led Zeppelin release. I mean, Led Zeppelin have kind of been notoriously stingy with the vault stuff. I mean, it wasn't really until 2014 that we got, you know, probably a cleaning of the vault, or at least as much as, you know, they probably are willing to offer. I mean, but yeah, this was a big release at the time. You know, this was a time when, you know, of course, Led Zeppelin, you know, they broke up in 1980 and have been, you know, with, except for some brief little spurts of activity, you know, have not really had any sustained kind of a reunion. So, you know, they were able to kind of, you know, ride this into a lot of money. I would imagine it's sold pretty well. And I think there was, you know, they even had like an official sort of Hollywood premiere type thing for the DVD release. So it's a great performance. There's just, like I said, these guys are at their absolute peak of their powers. The testosterone, the imagery, the majesty, the power of the hammer of the gods. Interestingly enough, it starts off with this thing called the LA drone, which apparently was just, you know, it's just this little musical drone that kind of leads into Immigrant Song, but it's kind of interesting. One thing that's interesting about Immigrant Song is that the audio for this is included on the DVD, but it's used as the soundtrack to a clip from a different show. Like, they just have a video or film of the Immigrant Song, and, you know, they do disclose that it's, you know, the audio is from a different, is from this source, and that the video is from a different source. So they're not trying to, you know, con us or anything.
Pass it off. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't bother me. I mean, I think it matches up, and at least you get to see at least one glimpse of from that era. Unfortunately, the DVD doesn't have any video or audio. I mean, video from these shows.
Just noting you mentioned the sales. It was released in June 2003, and it did reach number one in the charts, and it was on the charts for 16 weeks, was certified gold and then platinum. So absolutely, it was a big seller and a successful release. Do you want to just maybe hit some highlights from various songs, or call out some of your favorites from the...
Sure, yeah. Obviously, you know, it starts off great with Immigrant Song. One thing I
like that version. I think
it's great. And it adds something that's not on the original studio recording. It adds a guitar solo.
Exactly. Yep. There's a guitar solo. So it's a little bit longer. I actually think it's more powerful here. It just, you know, that thing that often happens with live versions where just the energy of the live performance, I just think the sound of it, the sound of the drums, the sound of the guitar is more powerful. And Robert's voice sounds great, as good as it does pretty much on the studio album. He's not struggling to hit those high notes or anything. He comes out of the starting gate, all cylinders firing on this track. It's a great version.
Oh yeah, definitely a heavier version. I mean, I think just live, they're just kind of get caught up in the moment, and, you know, it's a great opening track for any Led Zeppelin show. I mean, obviously Rock and Roll would become an opener later on, and some of the other stuff, but this is, it gets off to a great start. One very notable thing about this, now this was recorded in June of 1972, and what is interesting is that there are some tracks here, some of the songs here rather are songs that are going to end up on the next album, Houses of the Holy. And this was during a time when bands would do stuff like that. They would try out material on audience to see how it played out, maybe to work out the arrangements and see how it, you know, how it came across, you know, and to see, you know, okay, our audience is, you know, reacting well to this or not. I don't want to give away any of the tracks here, and I won't, but it's certainly kind of interesting to go to a show where you're hearing maybe half of your next album live. And I don't know if they had recorded it yet or if they were about to, but obviously they were at least in the process of working up material for it.
Right. Yeah. Live shows in the 70s and into the 80s, I guess people just had a little different approach just to going to see a band, where you were more forgiving of bands playing not only stuff from their new album, but stuff that you hadn't even had a chance to hear yet. Whereas now it seems like people get all hot and bothered if they don't play all the hits. You know, you have all the casual fans that just want to hear the hits. You know, this was a band that would go out and play whatever the heck they wanted, including new material you never heard before. They would take some songs and stretch them to the ultimate limit of how long you could potentially stretch a song. And there was no thought to, you know, we got to get all the hits in or whatever. I don't think they cared about that stuff at all. They played songs that they felt they could pull off best live and created a great show. Just the whole ebb and flow of a great show. You've got that little mini acoustic set in the middle.
Yep.
Didn't have a lot of bands in those days that were doing something like that. Yeah, it's a great show. A couple of my favorites. The third song, they open with Immigrant Song, then they do Heartbreaker, which has an extended guitar solo in it. So there, you're right in the second song, you're already stretching things out with an extended solo. Mm-hmm. Then they hit Black Dog, but they open it with the riff from Out on the Tiles, right? Which is just one of those things that they would kind of do. They would, you know, throw little riffs and bits and pieces of things here and there. I think that's kind of cool. It's a great version of Since I've Been Loving You. Jimmy's just on fire. That's just such a great song. It's hard for them to do a bad version of it, but it's a particularly good version here. I like that. I mentioned the mini acoustic set, going to California. That's the Way and Bronner Our Stomp. That's the Way is such a great, and I think underrated Led Zeppelin song. I'm so glad to see it here because it sounds great. It's a great version of that.
Oh yeah. And like you said, you know, how many bands were doing something like this, you know?
Yeah.
You've got Going to California. And of course, at one point, you know, Plant kind of, you know, mentions Joni, because obviously this song was kind of a tribute or a love letter to Joni Mitchell in part. And Bronner Our Stomp, he, at one point, Robert Plant does say Strider, which was the name of his dog.
Yep.
And I think some of the lyrics of the song were, you know, about that, or at least a reference to it. But yeah, how many bands were doing stuff like where you just slow things down, sit down, get out the acoustics, and just, you know, play a little back porch, you know, blues. And right, that's what they're doing here. And, you know, Led Zeppelin was known for that. And that's a tradition I think that would continue through. Actually, I think they kind of abandoned it for a while, but then they brought it back in the late 70s. But I, you know, it must have been nice for them to kind of just, you know, turn the amps off for a little bit and just kind of go for something a little more natural. And, you know, Jimmy Page is an anomaly in that he's one of these people who can sometimes be a little sloppy on the electric guitar, but oftentimes on the acoustic, he can finger pick flawlessly. And it's just one of, you know, Jimmy Page's many weird little anomalies. But on the other hand, it makes for a great performance. And it's definitely, like you said, it's nice to hear something like That's the Way, which is not a, you know, which wasn't a real hit for Led Zeppelin or one of their bigger songs.
Yeah, it's an album track, you know. I mean, Immigrant Song, Heartbreaker, Black Dog, Since I've Been Loving You, of course, Stairway to Heaven, Days and Confused. So many of the things on this record are live staples for them. But then to have something like That's the Way thrown in here, and it's a great version of it. So that's a favorite moment of mine. But yeah, like I mentioned that Wings Over America record, and Paul McCartney does kind of the same thing there, where in the middle of the set, they break out the acoustic guitars and he does Blackbird and Yesterday and stuff. But I bet that was a few years after this. So I'm sure that seeing Led Zeppelin do that was an inspiration for them to do that on that show. And of course, it's been done. A lot of bands have done that since then, but it wasn't all that common, certainly back when they started doing it, that in the middle of this huge arena rock show, that you would just put the electric guitars down, pull out a couple of stools and play some folk music in the middle of it. And the audience went right along with it. You know, that's just such a great, you know, the fans are with you when they'll, I almost said when they'll put up with it, but that's not the way at all. I mean, that they love it. You know what I mean? They love it when you crank the amps up. They love it when you do the extended solos, and they love it when you sit on the stool and play a little acoustic-y numbers. It's it's that synergy between the band on stage and the fans in the audience, and the give and take between the two. And you can feel it on this record. Partly what makes a great show is the audience response to the performance.
Right. And of course, you know, Bronnie or Stomp, they do have, you know, John Bonham on that song with the, you know, doing the kick drum.
Right.
One of the hardest, heaviest thing kick drums you've ever heard in your life.
Right. And he's also doing the backing vocals. They kind of do like it in sort of in harmony or whatever. He and Robert on this, don't get to hear Bonham sing that often, but you do on this version. Anything else that stands out to you from this record?
Moby Dick was, of course, you know, John Bonham's drum showcase, which, you know, is 19 minutes. So we're talking about a guy who's playing for nearly 20 minutes. But, you know, it's got the typical, it's one of the few drum solos that's worth kind of sitting through and listening to, because it's John Bonham and he's not just kind of doing standard drum fills or drum licks. He's, you know, he's really pouring himself into it. It's very like caveman-esque in its execution, but you know, it's John Bonham just kind of unleashing his fury on the drums. And, you know, it's obvious, you know, especially when you listen to this CD or album, that, you know, he's proving his reputation as one of the greatest rock drummers of all time. I mean,
sure.
Can you imagine Led Zeppelin without John Bonham?
No, but we've talked about this in all the other episodes too. Yeah. It's without any one of them, it's not Led Zeppelin. You know, each one contributes so much, and a unique perspective or a unique take or a unique contribution that couldn't come from anyone else. So you've got Page and Plant up front, but you've also got just the sheer muscle of Bonham, but also he could be super tasteful too. He was not just a Neanderthal pounder, you know what I mean? He could be delicate when it needed to. He could swing when it needed to. He could lay back, and he could push the songs forward like a steamroller when he needed to. You can't really say he's an underrated drummer.
Because
he's one of the handful of drummers that virtually every drummer refers to as an inspiration. So he's definitely not underrated, but he earned every bit of that rating. I wouldn't call him overrated for sure. And of course, John Paul Jones, as we always say, man, he's the utility player. He's the guy who's just in the background, but contributing so much that makes the songs work. Just all four of them together it's magic.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, getting back to Bonham, you know, during like Dazed and Confused, Page quotes some other songs and, you know, riffs and bits of other things. And one of them is a song that will end up on Houses of the Holy a year later. And it's John Bonham just showing how funky and how, how he can really kind of embrace his R&B roots. I mean, obviously, I'm sure all the guys in Led Zeppelin were influenced by R&B and blues, but, you know, Bonham was known for being a fan of, you know, Motown and soul music and, you know, really loved that kind of stuff. So, you know, he's not above showing his roots in anything he plays, but, you know, it's nice on a song where, you know, Dazed and Confused, where it's basically just a sort of solo showcase for Jimmy, you know, Bonham can kind of rise to the occasion and give him, you know, some of that funkiness and some of that and whatever he needs to kind of embellish his own little, you know, half hour of feedback and, you know, violin bow tapping and just crazy excess. But, you know, Led Zeppelin was about excess in all of its forms. And that certainly, you know, pervaded their live performances as well. You know, like you said, you know, Dazed and Confused here, it's 26, almost 26 minutes long, which is, yeah, believe it or not, kind of short. There, I think there have been versions of Dazed and Confused that go on for like a half hour longer. You know, I believe there might even be one that goes up to like 40 minutes. But, you know, on the other hand, Led Zeppelin is probably one of the few groups who can pull that off and not have, you know, people walk away or, you know, go to the concession stand or go to the bathroom. You know, I mean, I'm sure, a lot of the people, some of the people there were probably stoned too, which probably helped, but.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too, is you think about that, just the staging was so pretty primitive by today's standards. I mean, today, if, you know, you go see any band, just the your average arena band has got all kinds of lights and video screens and production and smoke bombs and, you know, fog machines and all of that stuff to keep you interested or keep your attention. And these guys weren't really doing a lot of that. Just, you know, some stage lights and a little bit of fog, but, you know, they didn't have all these screens and all that stuff. So when they're going off on a 25 minute excursion, it's really just the four guys on stage that you're watching. There's not a lot of other production, which just makes these kind of things, I think, even more bolder, you know,
right,
to not have that other stuff. You know, we both are Kiss fans or recovering Kiss fans. And that's, you know, they always had that extra stage.
Oh, sure.
You know, in fact, they brought a lot of that, for better or worse, into live performance. But these guys didn't do that kind of stuff. You know, Robert Plant was not puking blood or breathing fire. You know what I mean? It was just these guys on stage. So Jimmy and the violin bow, which I think maybe it's just because I listened to this record again fairly recently, and so it's fresher in my mind, but I kind of like this version of Dazed and Confused. It's certainly the violin part better than his performance on Song Remains the Same. I don't know your take on that, but I think it's really effective here.
One thing I do find interesting about this, now the total tracks are 18 songs, and one thing I find interesting is that Stairway to Heaven is fairly early in the set list.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was something I was thinking we should talk about and I forgot about, was that if ever there was a song built for the big encore, it's Stairway, right? And when Robert announces Stairway, the crowd goes nuts. So it's not like people didn't recognize the song. The song was already hugely popular, everyone in the audience was, but it's like what, song number 7? So it's in the first third of the set, which is awfully early to bring that song out, which I'm not sure what that says, whether or not they were already at that point not distancing themselves, but maybe downplaying it a little bit, or maybe just their sheer confidence and bravado that they didn't need to play that as, you know, they didn't need to put that song in a featured spot in the set. It's just one of many songs that they play, just happens to be song number 6 or 7 that they play. But yeah, that's the kind of song that almost everybody would put as your last song of the night or your encore, or the song right before you end the official set. And here they just stick it in the middle, like it's just your run of the mill song.
Well, maybe at that point it hadn't quite acquired that legendary status. I mean, it was probably still relatively new at this point. I mean, this is the Led Zeppelin 4 tour.
Right.
So, you know, it, you know, obviously hadn't ascended to become, you know, one of the great rock anthems. I think of, like, if this show were happening now, like you said, this would be the, like, the final encore, or maybe the last, or one of the last songs on the night. It would definitely not be this early, because it just seems kind of like, wow, you're really kind of pulling out your big guns already. Not that there aren't several great songs ahead of this and some classics, but yeah, this song definitely sounds more like it should be poised towards the the end of the set or later, much later in the set. But, you know, maybe at that time they just didn't feel it was, you know, it warranted that, or obviously they just wanted to structure. I'm assuming that this set list is based on, you know, the set list of the actual show and how it actually proceeded. I mean,
right,
this isn't like the 70s, because this was originally configured for CD. So they didn't have to worry about, you know, sequencing it differently to meet vinyl constraints.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I think it's, I could be wrong. Maybe you would remember. I think it's maybe the BBC Sessions disc. But there's, I remember hearing some performance where they play Stairway and they announce it and the crowd barely responds because they're not familiar with it. It's clearly a new song at that point. And they're maybe hearing it for the first time. Whereas here, the crowd does kind of, I mean, they recognize the song when, as soon as he says Stairway to Heaven, the crowd, maybe the biggest cheer of the night for a song. So it may not have, it, I mean, how could it have released, reached the iconic status that it has today as one of the, is the, I think it is the most played rock and roll song of all time.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, if it isn't the most, it's got to be at least the top three.
It's up there in terms of radio play, is, yes, yeah, one of the most played rock songs of all time. But it was not an obscure number at the time either. I think, clearly the fans know the song. So, yeah, it's just an interesting footnote that the song appears where it does in the set list.
And the song ends, of course, with Bring It On Home, which is from Led Zeppelin II. And, you know, there's a pretty rollicking live version, certainly ends the show on a high note. And I don't have too much more to say about that, Brad.
No, but it is an interesting song to pick. I mean, you talk about Stairway being the perfect end of night closer. I don't know that if I had to look at the Led Zeppelin catalog, even to the date of the four albums that were out at the time, that I would have said, why don't you close the set with Bring It On Home? You know, it's an interesting choice to be the last song of the night. Not that it doesn't work, but it's just an interesting choice.
Yeah, I mean, and that's pretty much all I have to say about this album, Brad. I don't have too much more to add unless you could think of something else.
No, not really. I mean, if you look at reviews on the internet, pretty much everybody, even people who are sick of Led Zeppelin, reviewers typically say, like, this is the live record to get if you want to understand why Zeppelin was considered to be just one of the biggest live bands of the day, a band that really earned their reputation on stage, that this is a record to check out. And I can't argue with that. It does show the band at their peak, full power, great performances, excellent set list, couple little surprises in there, like we said, particularly That's the Way. And it's a great show. It's a great moment in time, great moment in Led Zeppelin history. It's certainly something that should be in every Zeppelin fan's library.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, it's 50 years on, Led Zeppelin at their peak. Like I said, if you're going to buy this, if you don't already have it, get the 2003 original CD release so you get the complete Whole Lot of Love medley. And with that, we're going to end this episode of The Pod Remains the Same, a Led Zeppelin podcast. I'm Chris Karam.
And I'm Brad Page.
And we will see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Hi, Chris Karam here. Please check out my podcast, Mr. K's Super Show. Every month, a guest co-host and me take a look at music and music-related pop culture and break it down. Nothing is too trivial when it comes to the great music of Generation X. Let's go back to a time when music was fun, dynamic, and worth saving your allowance money for. Mr. K's Super Show can be found on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, and wherever fine podcasts are hosted. Check it out. You may not regret it.
Hey, this is Brad Page from the I'm in Love with That Song podcast. On our show, we discover what goes into making a great song. We explore the history of the artist and the story behind the song to see where it came from. We listen to individual tracks to understand the foundation that a great song is built on, like this drum track from Rush.
and we focus on specific performances that are simply magical, like this unforgettable moment by Mary Clayton on this Rolling Stones classic. In the end, we have a better understanding of what makes a song great. This is the I'm in Love with That Song podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network.
You have been listening to The Pod Remains the Same, a Led Zeppelin podcast. If you like what you just heard, please write a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode on Facebook, Twitter, or whatever social media you like. On behalf of Brad Page and myself, Chris Karam, thanks for listening to The Pod Remains the Same.